Good morning. I want to welcome you to Hill Country Bible Church. For those of you who are joining us at Brushy Creek and Steiner Ranch, we also want to welcome you. And we're a couple weeks away from an election, and the polls would demonstrate that most of you, if not all, are not happy with our candidates. And so there is, with many people, just kind of this sense of despair and conflict with friends and family members and so forth. And the one thing I would say is, if you're a follower of Jesus, there's a very important psalm. In Psalm 46, it tells us to be still and know that I am God. In other words, the Hebrew word be still means to cease striving, to quit fighting, to quit worrying, and to trust God. Trust God. In other words, take your fingers off the keyboard for a second. You know, let the smoke rise from your blogs. Just kind of let that go for a while. Maybe turn off the news and just lean into God. God is, he's good at taking care of things in the world, and you're better when you're not all wrapped around the axle. So you have more to contribute when you're not. So today, we're going to continue our series that we started a couple weeks ago, and the whole title of the series is In God We Trust. And my subtitle was Politics and Culture Without the Personalities. And so we're talking about things that are going on in our culture. For those of you who are new, we normally teach through the Bible. We'll take a book of the Bible and teach through it and explain what it meant and how it applies to us today. But I thought I'd take some time out and just focus on the culture and ask the question, what is the Christian response? How should we be dealing with these issues? And I made three promises at the beginning. I'll repeat them to you again. First of all, I'm not going to tell anybody how to vote. Let me say that one more time. I'm not going to tell anybody how to vote. Secondly, I'm going to say some things that you don't like. How do I know that? Because I'm saying things that I don't like. Not everything that's going on is likable right now. The third thing is I am going to say some things that you're going to make the supposition that you think I mean something that I actually don't mean. So here's my request, that you don't tune out, that you don't walk out, and that you don't start composing an email in your mind. Actually listen to the whole thing so you know what I actually said, then take offense, okay? But at least hear the whole thing. So we're talking about immigration today, one of the more difficult topics facing us as a people. Next week, we're going to talk about race relations and law enforcement, and I'm real excited to let you know that the police chief of Round Rock, my friend Alan Banks, African-American man who's been involved in both sides of this issue personally and then as a law enforcement officer, is going to be joining us, and he's going to help me teach through this. So really encourage you to come. You're going to get a lot of perspective. He's a prince of a man. He's a great guy, and I've worked with him for a while now, and you're going to be excited to meet him if you haven't met him yet. And so that's next week. But today we're talking about immigration. As I've been working on this topic, it's amazing to me why there's so much hateful rhetoric and there's so much lack of information and so many myths surrounding what's going on. It's almost as if the people who are leading our country do not really want us to engage meaningfully. And so, therefore, a complicated issue that's very important oftentimes is polarizing people that I think would have more in common than what they think they do. Now, in order for me to get through a topic like this, I'm going to need your help. So I'm going to ask you to identify yourself. In a room like this, there's usually two kind of types of people, how you're wired. Some of you are wired around compassion. Like, you're just a compassionate person. And when you are thinking about an issue, you immediately go to the question, how are people being treated? And that's kind of the most important thing for you, and you're emotionally connected to an issue. Any people that's kind of like you, did I describe you? Okay, that's a good thing. You're a good group. The other type of people in the room are typically people that are wired around order. Like, isn't there a right way? Isn't there a right answer? Can't we come up with a system? Can't we fix things through procedures? Anybody here like that? Oh, wow. Compassion people, you're going to have to step up. Okay? Here's what I want you to know. God did not create people with a heart of compassion and people with a heart for order so that you would fight with each other. He created different views so that we could actually make things better. So what I would say to those of you who are compassionate, by us not coming up with the same way to comprehensively approach the issue of immigration in our country, we're hurting people more than you know. And for the people that are wired around order, by us not coming up with a compassionate, comprehensive plan, we're hurting people more than we need to. But I think we can come together and kind of work through this. So as we do that, I just want to invite you into this conversation. So here's what I want you to know if you're a compassion person, that when a person approaches the border of the United States, whether it's the physical border in the southern half of the United States or whether it's the mental border about how I get in, they get three different messages. In fact, you can almost hang them on the fence so they're not visible on the fence. One of those messages is, keep out. One of those messages is, help wanted. And one of those messages is, cartel payday ahead. And that's a signal that our current system is sending to people. You want to know how bad it is? Let me show you a billboard in Austin right now. This is up in Austin right now. Undocumented immigrant, before you get deported, get a sugar daddy by arrangementfinders.com. Now, I can't imagine what people feel and think and what they're experiencing when this is the kind of messages that are kind of public out there in the public. I mean, how many women want a sugar daddy? Like, really? You really want that? Some of you are saying, well, compared to the daddy I got, I'd like to get a sugar daddy. But I mean, it's almost dehumanizing to be able to say, here's the way for you to find an identity in this country, and here's how, you'd have to give yourself. Like, that's what's actually going on. So for you who are compassionate, by us not figuring out a way to deal with this, we're sending these mixed signals, and it actually hurts people in the long run, okay? On the order side, we need to wrestle with how we look at people, and that's where I want to start today. So I'm going to start with the Bible from a Christian perspective, and I know some of you are not Christians here, and you're coming to listen in, but from a Christian perspective, I want everybody to know what the Bible says, what God says about people. So order people, listen in carefully. Here's the first thing that I want you to get. People matter to God. People matter to God. Here's the key. Here's what you need to know. The Bible teaches that every single human being on the planet is created in the image of God and has inherent worth, not earned worth, but inherent worth because they are loved by God. That idea, that Christian idea, that's rooted in the pages of the Bible is actually radical and revolutionary when it comes to government. And the United States government, guided by much of the Christian ethic, actually chose to take this idea and embed it into who we are as a people. And believe me, if you go back and study societies throughout history, this is not something that was there. This idea of the inherent value of people. And so you guys know the Declaration of Independence, right? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. These are rights that can't be taken away. Among these, you know, John Locke had 19 of them, but among these, they just listed three: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's what our country was founded on, that people have inherent worth that came right out of Christianity and formed the basis of Western civilization and a society that's built around this idea that everybody has value. And because everybody has value, how we relate to people speaks a lot about our view of God. And so in the Bible, in John chapter, 1 John chapter 4, verse 20 and 21, I want you to see what it says. If anyone says, I love God, yet hates his brother, he is a liar. For anyone who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he's not seen. God then becomes an idea, and your brother who's a real person, like, it's theoretical. It's all theoretical. He goes on to say, he has given us this command. Here's what God tells you to do. Whoever loves God must also love his brother. The basis of Christian teaching is that whoever you live with, whoever you live near, that you demonstrate love for them no matter what their religion is, no matter what their economic status is, no matter what their ethnic background is, and no matter what their legal status is. You treat them well, you love them. Jesus made this very clear. In fact, in a conversation that he was having with a religious leader, on one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. Here's what he said. Teacher, he asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? What's the big thing I must do? And Jesus asked the question, what is written in the law? In other words, what do you already know? He replied, how do you read it? And the man answered, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. Now, Jesus goes on from this conversation to tell the guy, hey, that's the right answer. Like, you've answered this correctly. That's the right answer. And he says, go love your neighbor. And the guy says, who is my neighbor? That's cue for, what's the loophole that I can get around to begin to disqualify the people in my life? And Jesus tells this incredible story about a person, a Samaritan, who was ethnically, religiously, culturally alienated from the Jewish people, and yet he shows more compassion than the people that are actually living there, and he tells this official in the Jewish system, listen, you need to take your cues from somebody that you don't love, because they get this, they understand it. In fact, Jesus went so far that he told us to do something that's unprecedented. Look at what he says. He says, you've heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. Well, how is God like this? He goes on to say, he causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good. He sends the rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. In other words, God's not discriminating. When he sends the rain, it falls on everybody. And so when you put out your love, it needs to fall around everybody in your path. Like, everybody ought to experience your love, regardless of their status. He goes on to say, if you love those who love you, what reward will that get? Will you get? Not even the tax collectors are doing that. In other words, quid pro quo. If you live by quid pro quo, you treat me well, I treat you well. Like, that's not laudable. Like, everybody does that. It's only God-like when you're actually loving people that don't love you, that don't treat you well. So Jesus is committed to this idea that people matter to God. So if you're a person that tends to think in terms of order, like if we could just get rid of the people that don't fit and just replace them with the people that do, and if we could do that quickly, then somehow we're going to solve our problem. I would challenge you on that and encourage you to think about people. Think about who you're talking about. Now, the compassion people are going, right? There's also another side to this, because God is both a God of compassion and a God of order. And the Bible teaches that God actually works through orderly systems. God actually works through orderly systems. In fact, when you look at the Bible, the New Testament was written during the Roman era. The Romans had a sophisticated system of basically migration and status within a country. They had a very well-developed system. There were 5 levels to identify who you were and how you fit in before the law. So the New Testament really doesn't discuss immigration or status at all. Like, there's no discussion of it. But the Old Testament actually discusses it quite a bit, and there are a number of verses about it. Let me just show you a couple of those. In Exodus chapter 22, 21, commandment to the Israelite nation, do not mistreat an alien or oppress him, for you were aliens in Egypt. Remember when you lived in Egypt, how people treated you? You don't do that. When you come to your land, the aliens here, treat them well. He goes on to say in Leviticus chapter 19, verses 33 and 34, when an alien lives with you in your land, do not mistreat him. The alien living with you must be treated as one of your native born. Love your neighbor as yourself, right? As your native born. Love him as yourself, for you were aliens in Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Now, as you're reading that, you may be thinking to yourself, okay, so does that mean open borders, anybody that comes, let everybody in, and it doesn't matter who they are? Actually, there's a nuance here that you won't pick up when you read the English text. And the nuance is this word right here. So the Hebrew word that's translated alien, sojourner, or stranger in the English Bible is actually a very specific term to refer to a very specific status, and it's used 92 times in the Old Testament. One of the Hebrew scholars says it this way. He says when the term chir, that's how you pronounce it in Hebrew, chir, applies to those who have religiously, philosophically, ceremonially, and legally joined Israel. So these are people who have assimilated and become part of the culture. They were not Israelites in the sense of being descendants of Jacob. In other words, they're not ethnic Israelites, but they were not simply immigrants. Their rights and their provisions came not from merely being there, but from pledging allegiance to the Lord and to his covenant with Israel. In other words, the chir are the people who are naturalized citizens. They came, they joined in, they connected, they lived under the laws, and they kind of left their origin or their ethnic backgrounds, and they kind of became part of the melting pot that became the nation of Israel. There are two other Hebrew words used to describe those who came into the land or came through and didn't assimilate or didn't become part of the culture. And those two words describe groups of people that are not accorded or afforded all of the normal rights of a citizen, whether they were ethnically born in or whether they came and joined in. So, let's just talk practically for a minute. The Bible gives the freedom to a nation to identify what it means to assimilate, to actually become legal or born in or part of, to fit in with the culture. And a lot of us think that, you know, everybody that lived more than 100 years ago had never even thought about this kind of stuff, and they didn't have any sophistication. But actually, the ancient civilizations, they had all kinds of rules related to these because there were big people migrations, and the idea of civilization means that you have united people together and they've agreed on how they're going to do life together. Common laws, common language, common customs, agreed upon way to live together. That's what forms civilization. And so if you have people that are coming and they're willing to kind of get connected to that, civilization can thrive. It can thrive economically. It can thrive in its justice system. It can thrive in its human rights. But if you get people coming in and there's this lack of connection, it actually can create some significant problems. And so when our country was founded, there was a sense in our country that the responsibility of the government at least began with looking at how we build a society for the people that are already here or that are part of this. And let me show you what we said. In the preamble of the Constitution of the United States, here's what they wrote. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union. In other words, the union that we came from wasn't that perfect, but we're trying to create a union. We're trying to create a civilization. In other words, the Constitution is going to limit some of our individual rights because our union together will be stronger, and we as voluntary citizens surrender some of those rights. You say, I never surrendered any of those rights. Well, just have your phone out, text messaging as you go through a school zone twice the speed limit and watch how fast you've surrendered those rights, right? Okay, we have surrendered some of our rights to form a union so that we would work together. Now, what does that union look like? It goes on to say that we would establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility or peace, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessing of liberty to ourselves. In other words, we're going to work together to make ourselves embrace liberty and to our posterity, that we would pass this on to our kids. Do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. So the idea is that a country does have the ability to wrestle with this issue of what do we share in common, who's in and who's out, and how do we take people that are out and bring them in a meaningful way. And throughout the history of our country, we've been doing this. So, having set that up, okay, the Bible gives us the freedom to create order, and the Bible gives us the command to treat people well. Like, what do we do? So, here's what I want us to do. I want us to talk about our current situation. And I'm just going to lay it out for you guys. And just let me just tell you on the front end, I am so deeply disturbed by what I've been reading and what I've been looking at. And the majority of what I've been reading and what I've been looking at, and when I say looking at, I'm talking about the pictures of the people that are being taken advantage of through our current system. It is so disturbing. And here's the crazy thing. The majority of the people in this room have no idea. With all the rhetoric, all the speeches, and all the articles that are published, all the news stories, most people have no idea. And it's absolutely crazy to me that the facts of what are happening in our nation are being obscured. So it's taken me, like I worked through the conservative article, I worked through the liberal article, until I finally find some facts and resources that actually tell the whole story. And most of what you read on your phone app is not the whole story. Okay, so I'm just going to let you know that as we dive in. So where are we in the area of immigration right now? What are the actual numbers of immigrants in our country? Well, let me give them to you. Immigration in the United States, the U.S. immigration population stood at more than 42.4 million, or 13.3% of the total U.S. population of 318.9 million in 2014. That's a pretty good number because it's about 2 years old, so I didn't bring anything more current up. So when we say, who do you mean by this 42.4 million, that would be everybody living in the United States today that was not born here. Okay, they were born someplace else. Okay, so 42.4 million, or 13.3%. When you put in the children, immigrants in the United States and the U.S.-born children added together, now the number is approximately 81 million people, or 27% of the overall U.S. population. Okay? So there's a significant number of people who live in our country that were not born here. Now, don't mishear me and think that I'm saying that there's that many people that are undocumented. We'll come back and talk about undocumented in a minute, but it seems like from the rhetoric that I hear every day that people are saying, well, we don't have any people that are immigrating and we don't let anybody in, and we used to be a country of immigrants and we're not a country of immigrants anymore. That, folks, is just not true. We are a welcoming country. We have a lot of people living here that weren't born here. And I think we all benefit from that. In fact, if you look at the Republicans, the Democrats, and anybody that knows what's going on in the issue, everybody believes in immigration. Now, how we immigrate, they don't all agree on, but everybody believes that we need somewhere between 1 and 3 million people immigrating into the United States every year just to keep our way of life going here, just to keep it going. If you're a baby boomer, and you want your Social Security check someday. I mean, the reason why you're not going to get it, first of all, the government's already taken the money out of the Social Security and used it, so that may be one issue. We talked about the national debt before, but the other issue is we don't have enough people to fill the workforce to pay the money in without any kind of immigration, because the reality is the population or birth rate of the citizens of the United States is so much lower than what it takes to actually sustain the population, that we need people coming here. I mean, that's just a fact. Everybody that thinks about this knows that that's a good thing. So it's not that we're not a nation of immigrants or that we don't have open doors to let lots and lots of people in. The question isn't whether we let people in or not. The question is, how do we let people in, and what are we doing with them when they get here? And we're going to dive into this just a minute, in just a minute. But let me geek out for just a second. So I spent time reading all this stuff, and so you guys just need to get a little bit of it. The United States has always had immigration policies. Just go to Ellis Island and read the requirements of what it would take to get in when people were coming from Ellis Island. I mean, we've always had those policies. Now, there are a couple policies that have happened of late that actually change the landscape and make things interesting for where we are. One of those took place in 1965 when a 1920s law was reversed. The 1920s law had a quota system on people from Africa and Asia, favoring Europeans, because the country at that time felt like it was easier to assimilate Europeans into our system than people from Africa and Asia. And in 1965, a law struck down that law, eliminating those quotas from those countries, and I think the majority of us would agree that that was more just and it's a better law. One of the things that was written into that law in order to try to keep families together was this idea that a person who does not have citizenship but is born in the United States when they turn 21 can sponsor all of their blood relatives to come in. So father, mother, siblings, wives, and kids sponsor those people to come in, effectively at that moment taking control of the U.S. government being able to kind of guide the process and actually putting it into the hands of the individuals who are here. So when you read these numbers and you see that when you add the U.S.-born children into the number, that creates, we've got a huge potential for immigration coming in the future that nobody can really predict who everybody is and where they're all going to come from. And so that's one of the things that I think we'll talk about in just a minute has actually created, even though it was intended to do good, people are finding ways to misuse it, and I think it's creating more hardship for the people that are coming. I'm not worried about the people that are here. I'm talking about the people that are coming. The other thing that's important to just frame this up as we dive into it is this. Many of you are not aware that in 1986, under President Reagan, there was a deal struck with the Congress, Democrats and Republicans, to come up with what they perceived at the time would be comprehensive immigration reform. And during that time, there were 4 million undocumented people that were given a path to citizenship. So many of the people who are coming from ethnic backgrounds, your parents or grandparents were actually given the pathway to citizenship, which has, you know, firmly given you the citizenship to be totally integrated into the United States. But that process that took place back then was different than a lot of what's going on today. And so there are a lot of people who feel like, well, I came in under a kind of amnesty, so why wouldn't we allow that to continue? How could we ever stop that in the future? It doesn't seem fair because I've benefited from that, so other people should benefit from it too. Over the past 30 years, the situation has changed dramatically, and though every president who's come along has promised comprehensive immigration reform, and most of them said that they would do it in the first 100 days, and some of them have put things forward, there's just been this mayhem of noise that's taken place, and during that time, things have changed quite a bit. Today, we have between 11 and 13 million undocumented people living in this country. So we had four in 1986 and said, let's give these people a path to citizenship, and then we're going to do a little bit more border control and a little bit more changes so that we can have a better flow. We can control how people get in and do it in a meaningful way, but that's never been done. So now we have a larger population that's living in the limbo of not having the rights of being here, but oftentimes working, paying taxes, and doing things like that, and more people able to come in, okay? So with all of that, I mean, most of you guys probably are not going to go back and read the history of immigration in the United States. And so that's just kind of an oversimplification of that, but you are welcome to do that, okay? Because it's different than what most people think. I think that we have four major challenges facing us as a nation and as a people, and I'm going to go through these very quickly, but I just want to get you thinking about these, okay? So the four major challenges that we have as a country, first of all, is assimilation. The question is, how important is assimilation to our stability? In other words, when people come into our country, as immigrants into our country, how important is it for them to have an opportunity and an expectation to begin to figure out what it looks like to be an American and to become an American? Historically, that has been a very high priority of the immigration system in the United States. However, today, in the political rhetoric, talk about assimilation is often obfuscated with critical comments or like calling people racists or something like that when you talk about this idea of assimilation. I want to decouple that rhetoric that leads us to going nowhere and just raise the issue. There are countries in the world, and not a few, that don't understand the rule of law because they are lawless in nature. And so therefore, whoever has money has power, and they control things, and it's a terrible situation to live under. But learning how to get around the law in some of those cultures is actually considered a positive cultural value. So if a person who comes from a culture like that, and I'm not thinking of any specific one, so anybody who's saying, well, you're talking about these people and these people, I'm not talking about any people. I'm talking about the world, okay? So they come, how many people who try to work around the law rather than accepting the rule of law because of their background and their past, how many of those people can we take in the United States and how do we work with that? Or a group of people that maybe have a different view of minority treatment, or maybe they have a different view of treatment of women. Can they come to the United States and hold on to those views, and how does it actually affect our civilization, our common values? And so the question of assimilation is actually a legitimate question. What are we doing to help people assimilate, and if they don't, how do we deal with that? That's a really big issue that we're wrestling with. Second issue is refugees. Do we take people for humanitarian reasons? Do we take people for humanitarian reasons? That's a really good question. That's a big debate that's going on. I actually think it's a smaller debate than the next two that I'm going to get to because we're not taking that many. And you're going to say, oh, yeah, but what about, but what about, but what about? Just stop the what about for a second. Let's just talk about it. And we're not taking that many. So even though it is an issue, and it also relates to assimilation, it's not one of the biggest issues. But we have to ask the question, with unrest going on all over the world, and political and religious and humanitarian refugees, what is our responsibility? Practically, how many people can we take? How will we support them? How will we help them? What will we do? That's part of this issue. The third piece of this issue, which I think really begins to get down to the big things that we're facing as a country, is undocumented people living in the United States. Between 11 and 13 million people live here without the protection of the law. They live here in a country where, because they have to stay under the radar, they have limited protection. They do. So, like, what about this group of people, and how do we deal with them in both order and in justice? And I think this is one of the biggest issues that we face as a nation. Unfortunately, what you read is not helpful. And it's sad to me. What you read is not helpful because a lot of what's going on out there is pushing an ideology or an agenda, not trying to tell the information. So let me give you just three little snippets of information that you can wrestle with. And by the way, it took a long time to get down to the actual data behind the propaganda. Is that too unkind? So Mark Twain said, one of his famous lines is, there are lies, there are damn lies, And then there's statistics. Okay? And some of you are still stuck on the fact that I said damn in church, and so you're having a little trouble getting past that one. But so just because somebody says statistics show, it could actually be a damn lie, right? So let me just give you some facts. I'm going to do this quickly. And then you're going to email me, you're going to say, that's not what I read. And so I'll send you the links. Okay, here we go. Questions. Do undocumented workers contribute to the economy? The answer to that is yes. And you'll read that in liberal publications. And then you ask the question, do undocumented workers take money out of the economy in the form of social services? And the answer to that is also yes. And you'll read that in the conservative publications. But it's really difficult to find somebody that's actually added them up to see what the real impact is. Okay, so I finally found the people that have added it up. It actually does cost the U.S. taxpayer money beyond what's contributed to the economy for the 11 to 13 undocumented to be here. It actually does. So everybody needs to know that, and if everybody's good with that, that's fine. Like, that's a compassionate thing to do. But we all at least just know it, right? Second one, wages. Do undocumented workers drive wages down? The answer to that question is yes, and it should be followed with a duh. Like, if you would have to pay $10 an hour, but you can find somebody who's hiding because they can't come out publicly that's willing to work for $7 an hour, that actually drives wages down. Okay, it does. So there are a percentage of low-wage citizens that are competing at lower wages because of our undocumented citizenry. Does it help the economy? The answer to that is yes. To the tune of $50 billion a year. And you say, well, who's benefiting from that? Who makes the extra $50 billion a year? Think about it. If I can pay you $7 an hour instead of $10 an hour, where does the money go? It goes in my pocket. And that's why the employers of undocumented people typically are making more money than they would have made, which is why a lot of conservatives do not want to solve this problem because their constituents are making really good money. And sometimes the non-conservatives or the liberals are seeing a voting block. This is tragic that that could be the case, but I can't explain it any other way. Let me give you one more crime. Do undocumented people commit crime at a higher rate than documented people or overall? You'll read all kinds of stuff all over the map on this. And what they do is really interesting. So when people say, no, they commit crime at a lower rate, what they're doing is they're taking the 42.4 million number and they're taking all the crime committed by all of the people that are not native born instead of just focusing on what's happening with the undocumented people. And at the murder rate, it's between 3 and 10 times higher than the average population. And before you get upset about that, which, by the way, took a long time to dig down to the bottom of these statistics, before you get upset about that, there's a reason for that, which brings me to the last thing I want to talk about here, and this is the most disturbing of all. Border security. Border security. Between 2006 and 2016, at the lowest end of the number, the drug cartels have executed over 50,000 people in Mexico and across the southern United States, mostly border areas. We are living with a major criminal enterprise that actually controls the flow of immigration coming into our country. And it is a humanitarian crisis. So why do we see more rapes and more crimes committed? because there are networks of cartel activity that are all throughout the United States with people being placed in all of these cities who, if they're there primarily as a gang cartel network moving drugs, wouldn't you expect to see more murder, more human trafficking, and more rape? The border has changed significantly in the last 10 years. Let me show you a map of the United States, and what this represents, these dots represent, are the nine major drug cartels and who controls what areas of the United States. In other words, they've actually divided up the United States into areas, and the cartels are moving their products, people and drugs, they're moving their products into the United States in that fashion. So what we've got going on the border is a whole criminal enterprise, and the crime of crossing the border without documents is the least issue on the border. It's who's bringing people in. In addition to that, the cartels are marketing to the Hondurans, to the Salvadorians, to the Guatemalans that we can get you into the United States, and if you can get your child in, and we can do this for $10,000. If we get your child in and your child can get in, then your child can turn around and sponsor all of you to come. And so compassionate families believing that what they're being told is being told to them by honest and caring people are scraping together everything to put their 12, 13, 14-year-old child in the hands of people that are criminals. In fact, here's what's happening. Unaccompanied minors in 2014, 68,500 crossed the border. Unaccompanied. We're on track to pass that this year, 54,000 in the first 11 months of the fiscal year. So here's what you need to do. You need to get online and Google the pictures of the bodies that line our border. Because here's what's taking place. A coyote is bringing a group of men, women, and children to the border, and they say, this is Texas. See that big, bright, white light that's shining up there? That light right there, just a few miles on the other side of that light is Houston. So I'm going to let you guys go from here. And they cross the border together, and they start working through this ranch toward that light. And when they get there, they find out it's a radio tower that's standing there, and Houston is actually 280 miles on the other side of that. And they're alone. They don't know where to go. They don't have any water. They don't have any food in many cases. And they're just left out there, and the ranchers in that area daily are finding the bodies of people that are dying along the way. But some of them are forced to carry drugs in. Some of them are being pulled into the sex trafficking. I mean, it's so bad that the coroners cannot even do the forensics work to try to find out who the people are so that they can hit the missing persons database for the people back home to let them know what's taking place. And so the coroners have begun to just dig these unmarked graves that have this little tin sign on it that say female and the date. In fact, one of the universities here in Austin has started sending their forensics teams down as part of their forensic training to go down and exhume these bodies to begin to try to do the forensic work to see if they can figure out who they are, because it's compassionate to get the word out. Now, this is not our border patrol, in many cases, is trying to enforce the border but save lives along the way. And nobody knows it, because nobody's talking about this. Nobody's talking about this. The old idea that a father has a drought and his family doesn't have food, and so he makes the hard decision and grabs his wife and his kids, and they make their way up, and they finally come to a place in the Rio Grande that isn't very deep, and they cross and they move into a border town. That's not what's been happening on our border since 2007. All of that's controlled by the cartels. And like we sit here and we argue and debate which one of these candidates has got it all figured out, and they're not even telling us what the issues are. So now that you're thoroughly depressed, And I hope disturbed, I looked at picture after picture after picture of young men, young women, old women, who their bodies strewn the border. So what do you do? Okay, let me just throw some things out to you. First of all, I would ask you to begin to see this problem as a human problem, not a political problem. If our politicians would come together and start talking about this as a human problem, I actually think we could solve it. I mean, personally, I'm at a point now personally, where am I? We need to do one or the other of these. Open borders would take the criminal element out of it. In other words, you drive up to the border, you show your Salvadorian papers, and we say, come on in. We'll take as many people as want to come. That would force the cartels wouldn't be able to pay, couldn't take money anymore. There's no reason. Now, the implications of that is everybody needs to get out your checkbook because everybody's going to need to pay more taxes to help assimilate the people, get them set up and move them forward. But at least that's humanitarian, okay? Or close the border. We're going to stop the smuggling of humans and the payola that comes from that. We're going to close it, and we're going to come up with a system of being able to bring people in a meaningful way so that they are not being used along the way. So I would challenge you, see the people. Think about the people that are involved in this, not the political wrangling. Second, I would challenge you to repent and confess and turn from your wicked ways. If you use illegal drugs, you have blood on your hands. You say, it ought to be legalized anyway. Well, it's not. And until it gets legalized, and until the cartels get out of it, every time you put a dollar in the hand of somebody that's smuggling drugs into this country, you are contributing to the deaths and the enslavement of people. Stop it. Every time you look at pornography, you put money into the hands of those who believe that they have a future exploiting children and women. Stop it. Prostitution. Stop it. This supports criminal enterprise. What if everybody in the United States says, we're going to go drug-free for 12 months, and nobody's going to click on anything indecent on the internet. We're not going to look it. We're not going to pay for it. We're not going to do it. Think about how that would change the whole complexion of this discussion. Think about how that would change it. Folks, we need to repent and become righteous people in our behavior, because you cannot get away from, if I support something that ultimately is damaging other people, it's my responsibility, like it's on me too. Last thing I would challenge you all to do is pray. We need divine intervention. Pray that God would break your heart for people. Pray that God would raise up some men and women who have the sanity to fix this problem. Pray for our leaders that they would hurt for those people who are being hurt, and that they would be willing to come together in sanity. Let's quit throwing terms that stop discussion, throwing those around, and come together. And it's going to take a supernatural movement of God to change this. We've gone for 30 years. 30 years. It's gotten worse. So I would call on you, if you believe in prayer, make it a commitment to pray. Next time you're about ready to get in an argument with somebody over your position, maybe just stop and decide to pray instead. In fact, let's do it right now. I'm going to ask everybody to bow their heads, and let's just take a moment to pray. Pray that, first of all, that God would break your heart for hurting people, and that God would raise up the men and women who would have the wisdom and the commitment to stop the injustice that we live with every day.